Diplomatic sources say that the U.S., U.K., Germany, and France have submitted a draft resolution against Iran's nuclear program to the IAEA Board of Governors. Russia says it's now in full control of residential areas of the eastern Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk. Venezuela slams the United States for excluding three South American countries from the Summit of Americas, describing the move as an act of discrimination. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iran is asking the Board of Governors of the IAEA to vote down a resolution proposed by the U.S. and its three European allies, Britain, Germany, and France. The draft resolution will be put to vote at this week's meeting of the 35-member board. It accuses Iran of failing to offer transparency over unexplained activities at three nuclear sites. But Tehran is warning the agency against politicizing its nuclear program. It says it's fully collaborated with the IAEA in resolving outstanding issues. The foreign ministry has dismissed the move as unconstructive, especially given the Israeli propaganda and support for an anti-Israel, anti-Iran move. Tehran says any such resolution would negatively impact both its cooperation with the agency and the JCPOA revival talks. It's pledged to give a proportionate response to any such move. The British Prime Minister has survived a confidence vote triggered by members of his own party. Boris Johnson has escaped losing his post amid growing calls for him to resign over a raft of issues, including the Partygate scandal. Saeed Purozad reports from London.
The moment of truth for the embattled British Prime Minister at the end of a day rife with speculation about his political survival.
Good evening. I can report as returning officer that 359 ballots were cast, no spoiled ballots, that the vote in favour of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes, and the vote against was 148 votes.
It's a result that means Boris Johnson is now a weakened leader and with an uncertain future, although he himself doesn't think so.
Well, I think this is a very good result for politics and for the country.
Just in, it's
just I do. Just in this sense, I think it's a convincing result, a decisive result, and what it means is that as a government we can move on and focus on the stuff that I think really matters.
But it's exactly this stuff that matters to people that forced members of his own Conservative Party to call for a no-confidence vote. Lockdown law-breaking parties held at government buildings at the height of the pandemic, when families were banned from visiting even dying relatives.
This vote was inevitable. We all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of getting the Jubilee out of the way. Why? Because the Conservative Party is really nervous about losing the next election. Let's not pretend this is about high principle. Boris Johnson was elected as an electoral asset. Now he's an electoral liability, and he's going to stay that way as far as I can see.
The sticky Partygate scandal played a major role in Conservative MPs challenging Johnson's position, but it was not the only reason.
It's about the end of party time in so many different areas. His green agenda is nothing to do with Conservative policy and is, in my view, directly responsible for the cost of living crisis. He's apparently failed to deliver on the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is essential to a unionist party, a party that doesn't want to see the breakup of the United Kingdom. And then there are small gaffes, times when he just doesn't look like he's taking the job seriously.
Things came to a boiling point over the weekend when the Prime Minister was booed at an event celebrating the Queen's 70-year rule. And prior to Monday's vote, allegations of intimidation and arm-twisting by number 10 trying to get Conservative MPs to change their minds. And the last-ditch effort by Boris Johnson himself writing to MPs begging for a second chance.
So Boris Johnson managed to survive this vote on his premiership, but by a number that will continue to be an open wound for members of his Conservative Party, which is why some experts say he won't be able to hold on to power for much longer. Saeed Purozad, London.
In other news, Russian and Ukrainian forces are locked in an intense battle in eastern Ukraine as the war between the two grinds through its fourth month. Moscow says its troops are now in full control of residential areas in Severodonetsk.
The residential areas of the city of Severodonetsk have been fully liberated. We continue to establish control over the city's industrial zone and the nearest settlements.
A fierce fighting is raging on the streets of Severodonetsk, with the mayor saying that the situation is changing every hour. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are outnumbered by more powerful Russian troops, but they still have a chance to fight back. He says Ukraine will continue the fight until it takes back all its territory from Russian forces and that a stalemate is not an option. Zelensky rejected speculations that Ukraine might cede some parts of its territory to Russia to end the war. White supremacists are no longer causing trouble exclusively inside the U.S. American authorities are now concerned about a battle-hardened extremists fighting in Ukraine who are set to return to their homeland. And that's particularly worrying about the rising violent incidents inside the United States.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's, in effect, another example of a proxy war. In this instance, between the U.S. and Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone.
The exact number of American nationals fighting in Ukraine is not known, but a report in March estimated it to be around 3,000. The challenge they pose to Washington is twofold. First, they will return to the U.S. with more military training, which could escalate the country's already alarming rate of domestic terror incidents. And second, they confirm the Russian notion that Moscow is fighting a war against new Nazis and foreign elements.
Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now that establish beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of the Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who were of Russian descent in the Donbass and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
Moving on, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has slammed the United States for excluding three South American countries from the Summit of the Americas.
What the U.S. government is doing is an act of discrimination against three peoples, three governments, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela.
And Maduro says that the exclusion of these countries won't silence their voices and that the U.S. is sabotaging the event, dooming it to failure. Several South and Central American states, including Chile, Cuba, and Mexico, have also blasted Washington's exclusionary move. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador responded by boycotting the meeting. He said that the U.S. lacks respect for nations and needs to change its policy of barring some while inviting others. This is the first time that Washington is hosting the event since its inaugural session in 1994. The U.S. intends to boost its regional leadership through economic collaboration, among other issues. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. China accusing Australia and Canada of spreading disinformation, and that after two countries blamed Chinese military pilots for dangerous maneuvers in international airspace. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says that Beijing resolutely opposes actions that threaten sovereignty and security under any pretext. Zhao Lijian was responding to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's comments a day earlier. Trudeau accused Beijing of harassing its aircraft during patrols to monitor UN sanctions on North Korea last month. China said that the UN Security Council has never authorized any country to perform military surveillance in other countries in the name of enforcing sanctions. Meanwhile, Lijian also reacted to Australia, accusing China of intercepting its spy plane over the South China Sea.
The Australian side has turned black into white, repeatedly has spread false information and advocated confrontation. China expresses firm opposition to this. We urge the Australian side to immediately stop such dangerous and provocative actions and to strictly restrict the actions of its naval and air forces. Otherwise, it will bear all serious consequences arising therefrom.
The Legion added that the Australian aircraft ignored repeated warnings and continued to approach Chinese airspace. It stressed that the Chinese military has always conducted operations in a safe, standard, and professional way, in line with international law. Australia argues it's not unusual for it to undertake surveillance flights over the South China Sea, but China said that pilots took reasonable but forceful measures in response to provocative behavior. Pakistan has summoned the acting Indian ambassador to record a strong protest over derogatory comments made by two Indian ruling party members against the Prophet Muhammad. People are also reacting angrily, calling for a united stance against the deliberate campaign to malign the religious personalities of Islam. Kamran Yusuf reports from Islamabad.
Pakistan has joined the rest of the Muslim world to condemn the Indian ruling party. Two senior officials of the Bharatiya Janata Party recently made derogatory remarks that disrespect the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Indian envoy in Islamabad was summoned by the Foreign Office to record a strong protest. In a statement, Pakistan says the remarks have not only deeply hurt the sentiments of the people of Pakistan, but billions of Muslims around the world.
People in Pakistan are outraged by the insulting remarks. They are demanding strong action against those Indian officials, as well as calling on the Muslim world to put up a united front against this religious bigotry.
After uproar in the Muslim world, the Indian ruling party suspended its two officials, but people feel that is not enough.
This is a test for the OIC. The OIC has issued a statement, but it is not enough. This OIC must take a stand and raise this issue with Mr. Modi.
We condemn this. Such sentiments against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, hurts the religious sentiments of Muslims. Pakistan's leading religious clerics have also condemned the insulting remarks.
All religious schools of thoughts in Pakistan have unanimously condemned what happened in India. We will work together and evolve a joint strategy against this incident.
The controversy has strained India's relationship with the Muslim world. Experts believe Indian ties could further deteriorate with the Muslim world if its leadership does not extend a public apology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Well, that's a wrap for this broadcast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The number of cases of Israeli regime's use of human shields recorded by human rights groups, both international and domestic, is ever growing. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Robert Inglakesh, political analyst, in an article published under the heading "Israeli regime is once again using Palestinians as human shields." Here's the story. On May 13th, a 16-year-old Palestinian girl named Ahed Mohammed Reza Mereb was left traumatized after being used by Israeli regime troops as a human shield according to a report from Defense for Children International Palestine, DCIP. Mirab said that during the incident, which took place during an Israeli regime raid in the Al-Hadaf neighborhood of Jenin, one of them, meaning Israeli troops, ordered me in Arabic through a small window in the military vehicle, "Stay where you are and don't move. You are a terrorist. Stand in your place until you say goodbye to your brother." She added, "I was trembling and crying and shouting to the soldiers to remove me because the bullets were passing over my head." A week later, the Zionist regime forces were again accused of the same tactics after a photograph appeared to show them using a Palestinian man as a human shield. As shocking as these reports are, they come as little surprise to most Palestinians who know, along with those paying attention long enough, that taking Palestinian human shields used to be common practice in the Israeli regime military. According to B'Tselem, Israel's top human rights organization, the Israeli regime military has used the human shields tactic since it occupied the West Bank, East Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip in 1967. The Zionist regime troops that have employed such strategies on the battlefield under what is known as Israel's infamous neighbor procedure, a friendly way of saying the Israeli military's human shield procedure. Up until 2005, the use of Palestinians as human shields by the Zionist regime troops had been a standard military practice for the Israeli regime army, legal under Israeli regime law. The Zionist regime's high court only banned the practice following a three-year legal battle brought by seven Israeli and Palestinian human rights groups who argued that it violated the Geneva Conventions. Just months after the challenge was launched in May 2002, 19-year-old Palestinian Nadal Abu Makan was killed while being used as a human shield. The death of Makan, which was concluded by rights groups to have been Israeli regime's fault, gave the case against the Zionist regime's human shield policy the push it needed. When the Zionist regime did eventually outlaw the practice, the Israeli regime army protested. In fact, the then Israeli war minister, Shaul Mufaz, appeared in court to present arguments to repeal the ban. The Zionist regime's war ministry specifically argued the case for practicing this policy inside occupied West Bank, despite it having been ruled a violation of international law. Since the use of Palestinian human shields has been outlawed, the Israeli regime military has attempted to place the ruling under review several times, arguing that it provides essential protection to their troops. While the Zionist regime's military routinely accuses resistance groups of using human shields in Gaza, it simultaneously uses the tactic itself and even argues for it to be legalized again. Former Israeli troops, speaking to Israeli group Breaking the Silence, have testified to having used Palestinian human shields after the practice was outlawed. Despite copious evidence that the Zionist regime forces have continued to use Palestinians as human shields since the practice was banned, very few Israeli regime troops have ever been brought to justice for their actions. The last time Israeli troops were punished for using a Palestinian as a human shield was in 2010 for an act committed during the Zionist regime's incursion into Gaza in 2008 to 2009. B'Tselem summed up the charges as follows. The two troops in question had ordered a 9-year-old boy at gunpoint to open a bag they suspected was booby-trapped. Despite the gravity of their conduct, putting a young child at risk, the two were given a 3-month conditional sentence and demoted from staff sergeant to private some 2 years after the incident took place. None of their commanding officers were tried. The number of cases of the Zionist regime's use of human shields recorded by human rights groups, both international and domestic, is ever growing. To see this emerge again, especially in the wake of the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, should be a turning point, educating the wider world about who is truly using human shields. No reputable international bodies or organizations have reported a pattern of Palestinians using their own people as human shields. But the Zionist regime military quite literally enshrined the tactic into their manuals for decades, and Israeli regime troops now continue to engage in these acts even after they were legally outlawed.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the lessons that we want to learn from Imam Ridha is to take advantage of the opportunity and the window that you're presented to spread the teachings of true Islam. It's not always that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala opens this window. But our ahadith say this, that there are times in your lives where divine breezes blow. There are windows of opportunity that Allah opens up. When the hadith says, make yourself available to those breezes. Right now, Allah has given us a chance to go over and explain Islam's teachings as is to the masses. Let's learn from Imam Ridha. Now, remember the time of Imam, because he was our Imam for 20 years, and he began his imamate in the time of Harun al-Rashid. Harun al-Rashid, brothers and sisters, was one of the most savage of the tawaghit. Of all of the Abbasid rulers, one of the most savage, one of the most muqtadir, one of those who was a law and order taghut, was Harun al-Rashid. The beautiful thing about Imam Ridha was that he never hid his imamate. He was open about it. From the beginning, from the time of Harun al-Rashid, people used to warn Imam, tell him, don't, blood is still dripping from the sword of Harun. How do you do this? Taqiyya. Don't use this opportunity to spread Islam as is. Harun, this is Harun we're talking about. You know what Imam Ridha did? He said this. He said that I take inspiration from that hadith of the Prophet. He said, the Prophet said, if Abu Jahl can take one hair off my head, then I'm not a prophet. He said, if Harun al-Rashid can take one hair off my head, I'm not an imam. What happened was, he recognized weakness. He saw fear in the eyes of the taghut. He recognized weakness. Some people couldn't see this. What happened was, and this is a long story, but I want to just summarize it. Harun al-Rashid had made such a blunder by first imprisoning his father. Right? For 4 years, the last 4 years of the life of Imam al-Kadhim, he was in prison. Before that, oppression, repression. But when he finally said, that's it, I have to murder him, and he finally murdered the imam, he paid such a political price, he couldn't touch Imam Ridha. Not that he didn't want to, not that he wasn't wicked, but for you and I, remember the story of Karbala? After Karbala, Yazid had made such a blunder by killing Imam Hussein. He paid such a political price that afterward Yazid had to send the family of the Prophet back with respect to talk about how bad Umar bin Sa'd was. Right? These are wicked people. But the situation was such you couldn't touch him. And the Imam used that to his advantage. He never hid his imamate. He was open about who he was, what he was doing, what he was. So remember we talked before about the secret organization of the Shia? That the Shia were moving and they had the secret organization and it was there from the time of Imam Ali. The people who were the true Shia were the people who were aligned with the Imam, ready to sacrifice for the Imam, moving monies around to make sure that activities were happening, the orders of the Imam were being carried out in various areas. Those were the Shia. This secret organization reached the height of its activity in the time of Imam Ridha. And the Imam was moving. During the time of Harun al-Rashid, he couldn't touch him. After him, there was a civil war in the Abbasid caliphate. The war was between Amin, one of the sons of Harun, and Ma'mun. It lasted 5 years. During those 5 years, our Imam pursued the direction that the Ahlul Bayt had always pursued. You explain the religion so that it matures in the minds of the people. You make sure that they've understood this revolutionary ideology. You take away the distortions that are there, that are keeping people, the way that they would like to introduce Islam will be an Islam that will put people to sleep. So he was over there doing that, and also readying that group of people who'd be willing to sacrifice so that he could carry out that mission. What happened now is once he was able to establish himself, Ma'mun, now he figured it was time to deal with the real threat, Imam Ridha. What did he do? And again, he had several goals in doing this because of his own situation, how tough it was for him as someone who was half Arab, half Irani, who didn't have the support of the Abbasids, with uprisings happens on the Alawis in his kingdom. The lack of popularity, the jealousy amongst the ruling classes, there was so much going on. He decided the best solution is to go over and make Imam Ridha the crown prince. I mean, what kind of a crown prince though? Imam Ridha's older than he is. He announces himself as his successor. But he said, no, I'll go over. But what happened was, remember, this is an imam who is open about his imamate. His father, Imam Musa, had been open about his imamate. You remember the story from the life of Imam Kadhim, meaning his father had introduced himself. People knew who they were dealing with. The story is this. One of the many stories. Our Imam, Imam Kadhim, Harun is someone who's trying to present himself as part of the family of the Prophet, as a good person, someone. He would do publicity stunts. He would show off that relationship that he had with the Prophet, the leader of the Mu'mineen. He said, I want to, as a family member of the Prophet's family, I want to return Fadak to you, Ahlul Bayt. People will cheer and they will clap and they will see that I'm such a great person. The Imam said, no, you don't want to give Fadak back to me. He said, no, I insist. He said, no. He said, no. He said, I insist. He said, look, if I ask for it back, I want the original border of Fadak. He said, the original border of Fadak. The Imam said, okay. He said, one of the borders of Fadak is the end of the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen. And they said, as soon as he started saying the borders of Fadak, the face of Harun starts changing. He said, one of the borders is Africa, Tunisia. One of the borders is Uzbekistan. By the time he finished, it was the whole kingdom, the Islamic kingdom. Harun was like, well, you take the seat then. There's nothing left for us. So his father, Imam Kadhim, had explained what an imam was. It wasn't that this is a spiritual state. No, I rule the Islamic kingdom. They knew who he was. He had always been calling for his imamate. Even his second in command, the man who ran his affairs for Ma'mun, he couldn't get, why would you say this person who says he's an imam with that meaning that this is your successor? Ma'mun pressed. And what happened was the imam resisted so long and kept telling him no and playing the long game to the extent that he started threatening him. And those who were carrying the messages back and forth, they would share them. It didn't make sense. This guy is being offered to be the crown prince. I mean, if I was offered to be the crown prince, that would be it. I mean, and he's refusing again and again. The message got out. It became clear that you won't take no for an answer. But not that the imam wants this. The imam finally, even once he brought him to Marv, the capital at that time, the negotiations continued. He started threatening the imam. The imam said, okay, I'll accept if I don't have anything to do with the government. He refused to support the deep state. I'm not going to sign anything. I'm not going to prove anything. I'm just sitting there. Everybody knows I don't want this. He had already told people, you Mamun, you're going to kill me. He told them, pray over me when I leave. Right? So the hope that Mamun had that I'm going to get popularity and people will think... The thing that happened though, Imam Mamun was now at the end of his rope, he accepted. What happened was that now that he was a government official, Imam Reza did something we had never been able to do. For 150 years, we were calling to imamate in secret, meaning you, as one of the Shia who are connected to the imam, you're meeting your neighbors, you're meeting your friends. If you see readiness, you see that this person is willing to listen, you take them aside, you say, by the way, there's an imam is this person, they rule. And the person, if you saw that readiness, you would invite them. Now, Imam Reza took it to a whole nother level. Now, openly, he's calling for his, because he's a government official, I'm the crown prince. We had never gotten to this stage. He saw that window of opportunity, the chance to explain true Islam, true Tawheed.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyim وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Limelight.
The ongoing dearth of baby formula has caused tremendous stress for American families. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Christina Selinsky, researcher. This article is published under the heading, Getting Formula Was a Strain for Many U.S. Low-Income Families Before Shortages. Here's the story. Miracle Abbott became pregnant during her junior year at the University of South Carolina upstate. She worked a low-wage job and had mounting student debt, so the then 19-year-old turned to the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, known as WIC, to get infant formula and food. But after she gave birth, her baby had colic and painful reflux, and her pediatrician recommended a special formula not available through the program. It took 4 months, 3 pediatrician appointments, and 2 meetings at her local WIC office before the program provided her with formula that worked for her daughter. She spent hundreds of her own dollars on formula in the process. That was in 2020, years before an Abbott manufacturing plant in Michigan was shut down over concerns about bacterial contamination. The February shutdown and coinciding recall catalyzed massive infant formula shortages in the United States. The ongoing dearth of formula has caused tremendous stress for American families nationwide, especially those who rely upon WIC. The federally funded grant program, administered by nearly 90 state, territorial, and tribal governments, accused for as much as 2/3 of all baby formula purchases in the U.S., according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which runs WIC. But the program's massive purchasing also limits choices for families and can make it hard for mothers like Abbott to get baby formula that is good fit for their infants. Those limitations began in 1989 after WIC administrators opted for a policy in which formula companies bid to become the sole provider for each state. States then offer a limited assortment of formulas for the winning manufacturer. Under the arrangements, the companies give state WIC programs significant rebates for the formula they buy. For every $1 WIC pays to the formula companies, it gets back as much as 93 cents in rebates, explained David Betson, an associate professor of economics and public policy at the University of Notre Dame, who has studied the WIC program. Rebate savings reduced annual program cost by $1.6 billion last year, according to the USDA. In a statement to KHN, it said the rebate system allows states to use their food grants more efficiently and offsets the cost of formula so that more participants can be served without increasing federal funding. And because of WIC's bidding policies, nearly half of all WIC-supported infants get formula from just one brand, Similac, which is made by Abbott. As a result, over 500,000 babies possibly had to switch formula after the February recall and plant shut down. Many babies do fine on just about any formula, but some parents find that their baby seems to do best on a specific brand and type. Parents often have to experiment a little bit and often end up trying three or more formulas to find the formula that keeps their baby comfortable, said Bridget Young, an assistant professor who studies infant nutrition at the University of Rochester Medical Center. When Jenny Moray, a mom of three in Florida, started getting WIC benefits, the formula her baby had been using was not one of her state's WIC-approved options. The formula WIC selected for her baby made him gassy. Officials at her WIC office told her she needed a note from her doctor to get a different formula, but her doctor said it wasn't medically necessary to switch. So she has stayed with that formula. Now, amid the shortage, she's struggling because WIC allows participants to buy only small cans of formula, and she said those are the hardest to find. I didn't even make dinner tonight because I knew we were going to be spending the rest of the evening just going from store to store to store in hopes that we will find some formula, Moray said. A few times, she has had to resort to paying about $40 out of pocket for a large can of formula because that's all that was available. The decision for such a state to have formula manufacturers compete to serve the WIC program has led to higher prices, Betson said. He found that wholesale formula prices across the board nearly doubled from when WIC implemented its bidding process in 1989 to 2002. Another study found that formula prices increased an additional 30% from 2006 to 2015. Betson said formula companies take a hit on the formula they sell via WIC and make up for it by charging non-WIC customers higher prices. Other economists, however, say formula companies instead benefit from an increase in sales after winning a WIC contract, and prices for non-WIC customers haven't been affected. And WIC spends more on formula than any other food, as the majority of WIC-supported infants, about 88%, get at least some formula through the program. Lower-income families are more likely to use formula because these mothers often face more barriers to breastfeeding. For example, about 25% of low-income individuals have to go back to work about 2 weeks after giving birth, said Iftewina Osido, an assistant professor at the University of California, San Francisco, whose research focuses on infant feeding disparities. Those same parents may also work in jobs that don't have lactation accommodations, and they may be afraid to jeopardize their jobs to ask for them, she said. Because of the federal program's high rates of infants on baby formula, WIC administrators have tried incentivizing breastfeeding by giving more food to breastfeeding moms, and some states have tried to limit access to formula for mothers who start breastfeeding. Emmeline Pratt, a mother of two who lives in Vermont, said her WIC office required her to meet with a lactation consultant to get formula, even though she explained she had already given up breastfeeding. The uncomfortable appointment left Pratt in tears.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom has a long history among Muslim clerics. This is the speech of the leader of the Islamic Ummah on January 13, 2020, by Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with the officials of the Martyrs Who Were Clerics Commemoration Congress. Throughout the thousand-year history of Shia's jurisprudence, these personages were outstanding, both the first martyr and the second martyr. We have a third martyr as well, that is Muhammad Taqi Barghani. But the term the third martyr is actually used for several individuals. Martyr Barghani from Qazvin, Martyr Sheikh Nurullah Shushtari in India, and many other martyrs. Later on, there were many other Muslim clerics who were martyred as well. But they were not known as the first, second, or third martyrs. For example, Martyr Mudarris and Martyr Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri were prominent Muslim clerics. They were martyrs from among the Muslim clerics. There are other such martyrs as well. In other words, the issue of martyrdom is not a new phenomenon among Muslim clerics, and we have had great martyrs from among the Muslim clerics. The same is true from among Sunni clerics. This is not particular to Shia clerics. There have been Sunni personages, both during and after the war, who were martyred.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Recently, we witnessed the martyrdom of Sheikh al-Islam, who was a very influential, effective martyr in Kurdistan. And there are many other martyrs who were either martyred in Kurdistan or in other areas. Well, these are some of the glories from among the Muslim clerics. We must not look at this issue by making a comparison between martyred scholars and people from other backgrounds. This matter is of secondary or tertiary importance. Rather, we should look at this issue by thinking that in inviting people to the good, Muslim clerics who were martyred were people who entered the field and risked their lives. This is very important. Today, we need to promote the idea among our young clerics and scholars that being a great scholar in religion and a high-ranking religious authority does not mean isolating oneself from the area of jihad. A scholar of religion, a religious authority, and a top teacher in the Islamic seminaries, namely our magnanimous Imam, entered the field of jihad and carried out that great endeavor, which was unmatched throughout the history of Shiism, considering the results that were achieved.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.